And then there were also these elements of danger in that all of these guys that were on the air, they were rebels. They pushed the envelope. They tried all sorts of different stunts and things.
Anyone who's listened to Rock Conversations knows that I was a humongous fan of The Loop FM 98 in Chicago. In the 80s, early 90s, it was the station to go to. You had some talk, you had a lot of rock, and you had some jocks, some DJs who knew their rock and could share it with you better than anyone else. The voice you heard at the onset is that of Rick Kempfer. He is the author of The Loop Files, brand new book. It's an oral history of The Loop that takes you from its infancy in the 70s through kind of its second heyday in the mid-90s. The talent there was incredible. Johnny B. in the morning, Stephen Gary in the morning, and then later in the afternoon. On the rock and roll side, you had Bob Stroud, Bobby Scafish, Patty Hayes. It goes on and on. And as you might expect, there were just a few interesting stories that occurred both on and off the air, in the hallways and elsewhere, at The Loop during its heydays. Two heydays, really. Let's get to our rock conversation with Rick Kempfer, author of The Loop Files.
Oh, let's go back, let's go back, let's go back again.
When you look back at The Loop, you kind of define the two great heydays within your book. Why don't you describe those heydays in a nutshell, both in terms of the years and what made them so great?
Okay, well, I'd say the first heyday was the late 70s, early 80s. That was when the Loop first started with the black t-shirt, you know, the Loop t-shirt times, the signature shirt that we sold like 2 million of those in 1 year. And that was when rock and roll was just starting to take over FM radio, and FM radio was just starting to take over AM radio. And the whole younger generation was latching onto this, and the Loop managed to tap into that. That's when they did Disco Demolition. They did all these huge events, and Chicago was just Loop crazy. Then the second major Loop era, the heyday, I'm going to say, is the late 80s and early 90s. And that's when the AM Loop started. And all these great personalities came here to Chicago to, I call it the 1927 Yankees of radio. All the greatest personalities in the country. They were all on one station, back to back to back, in the same hallway at the same time. It was 24 hours a day of complete and utter mayhem.
I've talked about it often on this podcast, but when I was still in high school, I would visit my grandparents in northern Indiana, Whiting, Indiana. Okay. And I just loved laying around listening to radio. And The Loop was kind of the primary station. You know, I listened a little to WMET before it changed formats, a little to XRT. But gosh, you summed it up. The late 80s and then early 90s when I was wrapping up college and then worked for a little bit in Chicago. It was crazy to listen to it because, you know, you had so much, as you say, so many different talents. I talked to Bob Stroud once on this podcast, and he said it was kind of a daily survival for sanity. That there were a lot of egos, and you kind of had the music side and then the talk side. What did you see when you were there?
Yeah, well, I was there at the same time as Bob. I was Stephen Gary's producer when we were doing the afternoon drive show. And I saw Bob every day. He described it to me as dangerous, that, you know, anytime you open the door to your studio, you could bump into anybody from Milton Berle to Jimmy Page. You know, you just never knew who was there, all the biggest stars in the world. And then there were also these elements of danger in that all of these guys that were on the air, they were rebels. They pushed the envelope. They tried all sorts of different stunts and things. And I mean, there was one day that Bob told me about that I wasn't there for, but Kevin Matthews, who was our midday guy on the AM, the 1985 Bears stormed the studio, duct taped him to a chair, took over the show and left him out on Michigan Avenue and then started doing the radio show. That kind of thing could happen at any moment.
I mean, you talk about two entities made for a marriage like that, the 85 Bears and the Loop FM at the time.
Yeah, exactly. Those guys had great personalities. You know, the 85 Bears, they were on every show all the time on our station.
So let's divide in the short time we have. Let's talk a little bit about the music side, and then we can talk about the talk side. How big a deal was it for the Loop to get Bobby Scafish from WXRT?
I think it was very important because we were changing our image from the hard rock, kick-ass rock and roll of the late 70s to more eclectic rock and roll. And Bobby Scafish kind of symbolized that. He was at WXRT, and he was known for his music knowledge. And we brought him in, and he had that hip attitude. So we were immediately hip again. And you know, with between him and Bob Stroud and Patty Hayes, who was on at night, we had some of the greatest rock and roll disc jockeys at the same time. At the same time that we had that AM station going on.
Exactly. And a shout out to Scafish. He's got a book that's on your imprint, if I'm not mistaken, right? We Have Company.
It's a great book. It really is. Interview he did with all the different rock and roll stars.
I didn't realize until I read your book that Daddy-O is kind of his catchphrase because he's bad at remembering names.
I didn't know that either. He called me Daddy-O the first few years I knew him. And then he started calling me Lime Ricky after that. That was his nickname for me. There was a bar around here called Lime Ricky's, and my name is Rick, so that's where it came from. But yeah, he's not great at names, but he is one of the coolest dudes you'll ever meet.
Oh, and he was perfectly situated, I thought, for afternoon drive.
Yes.
I go back and forth because I had a friend years ago who listened to him evenings at XRT, and he would argue with me till he was blue in the face, this friend of mine. He said, no, 6 to 10, that's where he's the best. I'm like, no, afternoon drive on the Loop, that's where he's the best.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Stroud is another icon, inimitable, likes to wear fancy clothes and shoes, as I learned previously and in your book. What I did not know is that he originally came kind of as the production director and then flip-flopped with Bisbee or Dave Benson. I can't remember.
Yeah. Matt Bisbee, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Matt Bisbee, I just saw him the other night at one of my book signings. He still says that Stroud was one of the greatest production talents he ever heard in his life. That because Stroud could do it all. I mean, he had a great voice. He also could sing.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
He would do like singing commercials and jingles and things like that. He's a very talented guy.
You know, outside of the inner workings, or those of us who have been exposed to the inner workings of radio, I don't think the general audience sometimes appreciates the value of a good or a great production director. And Matt Bisbee arguably was great.
Yeah, and still is. When, you know, the whole catchphrase at the Loop was, at the end of all of his promos, he would say, "On the Loop." And, you know, that was him. He said that, you know, all the time. I made him say it at the book signing I was at the other day to everybody who came by. This is him. Say it. And he would do it.
You're making me smile. You know, obviously we don't have video for our podcast, but it's like a walk down memory lane.
Yeah.
You know, hearing these different phrases, hearing these different names and voices. We're talking with Rick Kemper. He's the Kemper. He's the author of The Loop Files, a great book. Dare I say a great stocking stuffer or gift for the holidays. So if you're still looking for someone, get out and buy it. The AM, I think it's impossible to start a discussion about not just the AM, but the FM talk as well, without starting with Stephen Gary. And you actually produced them. I can't begin to imagine what that was like on any given day. Some of the stories begin to sum it up, but I mean, this sounds like it was just on a whole different level.
Well, to me, it was the ultimate being tossed into the deep end of the pool. You know, I wasn't given any instructions by them. It was just, figure it out. And then if I didn't do it correctly, I was lambasted in front of, 500,000 people every day. So that is great motivation not to screw up. And I think it made me into a very good producer. But he, Steve was, an improvisational genius. And Gary was the perfect punchline. You know, he He held back. Steve did the setup, and then it was like an alley-oop to Gary, who would put it through the hoop. It was a great team, and I'm honored to have been part of that show.
You were, if I'm not mistaken, you were part of the show when he had his vasectomy done on the air. Is that correct?
Yes, I was.
Do you still have a copy of that song, the parody of Close to You from the Carpenters?
I do. I have that. Yes.
You might have to share that with me because I was telling my wife about it last night. She's like, no way did this end up on the air. I said, how else am I going to know these two verses? You know, why is that guy suddenly come near?
That's hilarious. I have it on cassette. I'll have to figure out how to get it off for you. Yeah.
That was unique to say the least. Yes. Was that his idea?
It was his idea. And it was a great show because Gary had to describe it. You know, imagine, you're in the doctor's office, the doctor's, cutting things, and he was begging Gary to stop being funny because he didn't want the doctor to make a mistake.
And then I think I read, unless I'm hallucinating here, which is not always out of the realm of possibility, that the same doctor or a doctor remembered your role when you might have undergone the similar procedure years later.
Yes, it was in 2003. I was in the same hospital getting my own thing taken care of. And it was a teaching school. It was at Northwestern, a teaching school. So there were, like eight people in the room. And the doctor suddenly says, hey, wait a minute, Rick Kempfer, you're not the same Rick Kempfer that was on Stephen Gary's show. I said, yes, I am. He goes, oh my God, guys. And he starts telling the story of Steve's live vasectomy while he's doing mine.
I'm not sure I'd want someone losing their focus. Save the stories till later, right?
I wasn't happy about it, I'll be honest.
Did you recognize his name before you went in and know that he was a... Okay. So total surprise.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're talking with Rick Kempfer, the author of The Loop Files and former producer and on-air host, among other things, at The Loop. Ed Schwartz. Now, I'll tell you how your path and mine have crossed in odd ways, and you probably didn't know this. So summer of 91, I was hired at WGN to work the very prestigious overnight show, Steve and Johnny Putt-Putt. And I lived on Mitch Rosen's sofa on the north side.
Wow.
So I got to know Eddie Schwartz a little in that time because his show would precede Steve and Johnny's. I think they did like 2 to 5 and he was on 11 to whatever it was, 11 till 2. And, there's only one Ed Schwartz. When Mitch told me they were headed to the Loop, I was flabbergasted. I never would have predicted that.
We were even more flabbergasted at the Loop because Stephen Gary and Kevin Matthews had been making fun of Eddie mercilessly for years. Mercilessly. Kevin even had a band called Ed Zeppelin, which was based on Eddie Schwartz, in which, Eddie was a very large man. He was, like 500 pounds. Very, very large.
Right.
And Kevin dressed up in a fat suit and went out there and performed, blues numbers as Eddie Schwartz. It was a very odd thing. And then one day we were told, hey, we've got a new overnight guy and his name is Eddie Schwartz.
And it worked for a while.
It did work for about a year or two. And then Eddie started having health issues.
Speaking of health issues, and you mentioned earlier Northwestern, I'd be remiss if I didn't attempt to do my best Eddie Schwartz impersonation. So he had been hospitalized for a day or two when I was at GN that summer of 91. And he calls up Rose and he says, man, Northwestern used to be a nice Cadillac. Now it's just a slow Buick. And that was Eddie, right? He was always getting caught up in traffic if they had like a Parcheesi game in his. That was his excuse for getting caught up in traffic in his condo parking garage if he was going to be a little late for the show.
That's hilarious.
What was I going to ask you about here? My mind wanders. Oh, you talked about, how you could see each other. Steve and Gary could see Scafish and vice versa, and you'd sometimes alternate guests.
Right.
I remember once I was using a friend's car driving around South Bend, Indiana, and they had gone over to the AM at this time. So you had, Scafish on the FM, Steve and Dahl on the AM, and this car that I was driving only had AM radio. So, all right, I'll listen to Stephen Gary, which isn't a bad thing, but I would have preferred the music. And it, lo and behold, I got some of the music. So Steve was like bored or something. You might have been working this day. Maybe it wasn't uncommon. So he clicks on the FM feed, and they're playing, Scafish is playing Live and Love and Made from Zeppelin. And then Dahl's like, man, Scafish is kicking our ass over there. And then back to it. But I mean, the things that they said on that show, I think back to the day Len Bias died. And they were going through it. I'm like, whoa, you couldn't get away with it these days. But I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, that was done with any real malice. It was just their raunchy humor.
Well, we called ourselves equal opportunity offenders.
I like that.
Which, you know, there was no, there was no racial bias or religious bias, or, and it was funny or not funny. Those were the rules. And, you know, obviously we went over the line a few times, and, you know, we were scolded and brought back to reality. But for the most part, I think that it was all done in good humor. Today, I think a lot of it wouldn't fly, just between us.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I think of some of the jokes that I share with close friends only.
Right.
Exactly. For fear that it might really upset the politically correct folks. I'm putting it as delicately as possible.
You know, yeah, I know.
I can easily offend people too. So in the waning minutes, and thank you for your time on this. I always like to ask, or occasionally ask, unfair questions. So I will. If you look back at your time at the Loop, are there one or two memories that really stand out above the others?
Yes, I'd say there are two. One is I met my wife there. She was working in the news department, so that was, and we're still together.
That's a pretty good answer. You wouldn't want to leave that one out.
No, I led with that. It was good, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
That's 35 years we've been together. Then the second thing is I met a Beatle, which I met Ringo Starr. That was exciting. I'm a Beatles fanatic. So I think, I don't know if you can see behind me here, I've got a With the Beatles.
Oh, yeah, I do. Yeah.
So meeting Ringo was a huge thrill for me.
Tell that story a little, because I think it involved Joe Walsh, if I'm not mistaken.
It did. Yeah. So Joe Walsh was on our show. Joe was a good friend of Stephen Gary's, and he was touring with Ringo's All-Star Band. And just as a joke, Steve said to Joe, you know, well, why don't you get Ringo on? Because, you know, it was unrealistic to get a Beatle on. It just
right.
didn't, even for us who had everybody on, getting a Beatle just seemed out of reach. And Joe goes, oh, okay, sure. Hands me the phone. Gives me Ringo's number. We call Ringo. He's in the hotel, and Ringo comes on the air. And am I allowed to swear on this?
Yes.
Okay. So, Ringo gets on the air and he's very upset because he's listening in his hotel room and he can tell that he's on delay. And he's like, you know, of all the people in the world, I don't know that you'll find anyone who's done more interviews than me. I must have done 10,000 interviews and you don't trust me to be professional. I've been professional since 1960. You know, he goes on and on and on. And Steve goes, okay. We'll take you off delay. Took him off delay. And Ringo's like, okay, we're live now? Yes. And Ringo said, shit. That was hilarious.
You can't make that stuff up. One quick thing. Yeah, one quick thing before we wrap. I saw a documentary the other night, and I think it's relatively new. It's about Disco Demolition.
Yeah.
And it asserted something that I had literally never given any thought to, that Disco Demolition was rooted in a hatred of black music. And it was racist
and homophobic. Don't forget that.
Oh yeah, I just saw it as a great promotional event that maybe got a little up, maybe more than a little out of control. But we're still talking about it 40 plus years later. What are your memories and thoughts about Disco Demolition?
Pretty much similar to yours. I was of that age. I was a teenager when that happened. I was 16, and you know, I was part of the anti-disco army. But it really was not because we hated black music. You know, we were just rock and rollers. That's what it was. I mean, Jimi Hendrix was a rock and roller. We loved him. You know, Stevie Wonder, we loved him. We loved, you know, all that stuff. It was just the disco thing we didn't love. And it never occurred to us that it had any racist overtones, and it never occurred to us that it had any homophobic overtones. That came years and years later. At the time, what people were upset about is the White Sox had to forfeit a game. That's what people were upset about at the time.
And Mike Vec had to look for another job for years.
Yes, he did.
Luckily, he did okay for himself. He's a great promoter.
He is.
The Loop Files is the name of the book. Rick Kemper's the author. Thank you so much for taking some time. And again, it makes a great holiday gift for those listening before Christmas. And if you're listening after, it makes a good any day gift.
Thanks. I appreciate it. This was fun.